From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Reminiscing in tempo on today's Fresh Air, Mercer Ellington joins us to discuss his father, the late Duke Ellington, and the Duke Ellington Orchestra, which Mercer has conducted since his father's death in 1974. Also today, we meet the Washington Squares, three former punk rockers who got together to play folk with a new wave beat. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording of Bernard Herrmann's scores for some of Alfred Hitchcock's greatest films. And commentator Maureen Corrigan requests the honor of your presence as she discusses the New York Times wedding page. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Duke Ellington, one of America's greatest composers, would have been 90 years old this past Saturday. We thought this was a good time to catch up with his son Mercer, who has been conducting the Ellington Orchestra since Duke's death in 1974. Much of Mercer's life has been spent working with the orchestra. As a young man, he was the gopher. In 1950, he briefly played with the orchestra as a trumpeter, and in 1964, he rejoined as a trumpeter and became the road manager. Mercer also wrote several compositions that became part of the orchestra's repertoire, including Things Ain't What They Used to Be, Blue Surge, and Jumpin' Pumpkins. Last year, Mercer won a Grammy Award for Best Big Band Jazz Instrumental Album. The Duke Ellington Orchestra, under Mercer's direction, has a new album called Music Is My Mistress. That title is both the title of Duke Ellington's memoir and the title of a new extended composition by Mercer. This is an excerpt of the third movement of Mercer Ellington's Music Is My Mistress. An excerpt of Mercer Ellington's composition, Music Is My Mistress, from his new album of the same name. Mercer Ellington, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's a pleasure being here, Terry.
I was wondering if, in any way, your father's death liberated you as a composer.
Well, in a sense, it allowed us. In fact, you would think that it would have. But that's not true, really. I mean, I'm under the same restriction as far as competition is concerned. Competition with myself, early Mercer Ellington, and competition, with Duke Ellington, with the same problem he had. The things that he's written are so perennial that all our audiences request many of the tunes from the past, and they have such a great warmth and a great charm that you have to do them, and, you know. Can you imagine us doing a concert, say, without playing Satin Doll or Mood Indigo or Sophisticated Ladies?
When your father was alive and you wrote a composition, something like, say, Things Ain't What They Used to Be, would he listen to it and then critique it for you?
No. In fact, it was funny you should pick that particular tune because he called me up. He knew I was out in the street playing around, and he laid for me. He had the clerk in the hotel to give him a ring when I came in, which is about 4:30. And I had been complaining because I wasn't getting the opportunity to write anything and do anything about it. So he waited, and at 4:30 he called me and says, we have a session at 9 o'clock. I want you to do a side for me. I just reached for everything and anything I could find and threw it out there at him. And I've been trying to write like that ever since.
What was his reaction to it when he heard it?
His reaction was always, his compliment was always silence. His negative reaction was a suggestion. Well, you might have done this, or do you think this is possible, or whatever. And much as it was the case with him as an individual, to bring him to a point of decision or to get him to make an absolute statement called for a certain kind of treatment that you had to give him. I'd be in the dither as to how to get from one town to the other, whether to charter the bus, whether we should fly or take the train. If I asked him what should I take, I'd never get an answer. So my way of invoking a decision from him would be, well, Pop, tomorrow we're going to get up at 9 o'clock and take the train out to Philadelphia. And he'd say, well, what's wrong with the airplane? Then I knew we could fly.
Was it understood when your father was getting older that you would take over the band after he died?
Absolutely not. I mean, it never occurred to him. It never occurred to me. Only thing, if it had occurred to me, I would have studied piano much more seriously than I did. But all I cared about was getting into the orchestra. And I knew if I played piano, that wouldn't happen.
Mercer Ellington is my guest, and he's conducted the Duke Ellington Orchestra since Mercer's father's death in 1974. You played in the Ellington Band, didn't
yes.
you? Yes. How long did you play?
I was with them for 1 year in 1950 and left to form a record company. And then again, I joined them in 1967 to stay.
Did you have to audition to get in?
No, I guess the word is con my way into the orchestra. When I got in there as a trombone player, they were very short of musicians because the business was so good. Everybody who was a soloist could have his own band. But later, he needed a road manager, and all his friends had turned him down because they said they wanted to remain his friend. And the last man he could think of was me, so he called me up and said, I want you to be the road manager. I knew what trouble he'd had in trying to find someone. I said, yeah, I'll do it, on the proviso that I play trumpet as I do the road manager. So he put me in as a fifth wheel. Actually, I was a fifth wheel. There were five trumpets there at the time.
And that's how you became the road manager, too.
Right.
You ended up being the manager of a band where you knew all the musicians since your childhood. And
which is the worst handicap you can have.
Yeah, because they probably thought of you as the kid, even though you weren't the kid anymore.
And it wasn't that so much. It was just one of those things. They thought of me as the gopher. That was my first job.
So you'd have to run out and get stuff.
I still have it. I have every job left that I started out with. I still go get the sandwiches. I help with the baggage. I help set up the bandstand. And I have to do the copying and also make arrangements.
So how did you gain respect and a sense of authority when you became the road manager?
Never did get any respect, I guess. You talk about Rodney Dangerfield. It was one of those things where, you just hung in there long enough to be accepted. And I think this is the main thing. We had people who joined the band and quit because they'd come in for weeks and nobody even say good morning to them. There were no two men that hung out with each other in that orchestra except Bonnie Bigard and Ben Webster.
You know, it's so hard to imagine that because hearing the orchestra, it's such a really gorgeous unit. And to think of everybody squabbling all the time when they weren't playing is,
Well, I used to call them the Yankees. they were all great musicians and they could play wonderfully together. And they argued like mad, but whenever the weight dropped, I mean, they could come in and they would do the job.
Did you have to worry about disciplining the band members for lateness or for drunkenness or things like that?
you don't discipline a musician for being drunk. I mean, that's part of his creativity. And if you take his inspiration away, it's part of what it takes to be in this business. I was advised by my father to drink because you won't have the inhibition to relax and to even have flowing ideas. I'm not recommending drunkenness. I'm talking about drinking. And so if you're going to drink, one day you're going to have a little bit too much to drink and you will get drunk. But as far as alcohol is concerned, it has constructive purposes. I mean, even now, people advise wine instead of tranquilizers. So I will not admonish, or nor did I try to discipline anybody because of alcohol. I had things I had to try to get, instill. That was making time for bus calls and trying to keep the guys from, going too deep into their money, because I knew most of them had responsibilities. Not all of them, just a few here and there. But that's the kind of discipline you had to worry about.
So how would you take care of that? About, for instance, not going too deep into their money?
Well, we had one man. We only allowed $10 a day, regardless of what happened. When the $10 was gone, that was it. But every day he got $10 to start with. And I had another man that would have problems because he would have to get a drink or something. And I would make him first drink a mixture of eggs and sugar and everything that was nourishing, like get him to take a lemon and grind it up and mix it in with the drink before I would give him his draw to be able to go out on the date.
You know, I want to ask you something about alcohol again. Did you find that some musicians could hold their liquor well and really play really well after drinking, and that others really couldn't? And that it would affect their performance badly?
No, I never found... I never mm-hmm. saw a musician who could not perform well whether he'd been drinking or not.
Uh-huh.
It was almost protocol for Ben Webster to have a drink, or to... In fact, Pop would get Ben high if he possibly could every time there was a record date, because he knew that Ben was so busy trying to be absolute whenever he was recording for him that his nerves wouldn't allow him to play as well as he could play when he wasn't inhibited.
Huh. That's interesting. So how long did you stay the manager of the band?
Until Pop passed away. That was the job, 12 years at it.
Are you still officially the manager as well as the conductor?
Yeah, I told you I got all my jobs.
You're still doing them all, right? Okay. As several people have pointed out, I think music wasn't your father's only mistress.
Well, I mean, since you brought it up, I want you to know that when I wrote the theme title for the album, my way of composing it is that each of the themes represents one of the five most important women in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And the one, it's odd and strange that the one that you picked to play represented one of the most congenial and most beautiful and wonderful ladies of all. Her name was Evie. And it was that she was a very serious lady, and she's a lady he spent really the majority of his life with. He had paramours, but for the most part, she represented his real love. And he, from time to time, would take an excursion, but he always returned home. And as a result, we have a thing of like, I mean, I guess if he imagined himself to be anyone, it had to do with sort of his religious belief, and he kind of came up with a feeling that he was somewhat related to King Solomon.
What do you mean?
Well, King Solomon had I would say a bevy of women who represented him and his concubines and so forth.
How did you feel about your father having paramours? Were you comfortable with that as his son? And did you ever get close to any of the women who your father was in love with?
Well, I think so, particularly with Evie. Mm-hmm. That's the one we were talking about originally.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what he was concerned, the way I felt about it was this man had done such a marvelous job with himself and for everyone. I can tell you this, that during the course of his lifetime, he took care of an entire family. By that, I mean, you know, like people who were cousins, uncles, aunts, and so forth, their businesses had failed. And I felt that with him having done so much for other people to make them happy, he was entitled to the happiness which was important to him.
Well, I want to talk with you a little more about your life and about the Duke Ellington Orchestra, but first we're going to take a short break. Mercer Ellington is my guest, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Mercer Ellington is my guest, and he's led the Duke Ellington Orchestra since his father's death in 1974. Mercer and the Duke Ellington Orchestra have just released a new recording called Music Is My Mistress, and I want to play an excerpt of one of Mercer's compositions featured on this new album, and this is called Danish Eyes. An excerpt of a composition by Mercer Ellington called Danish Eyes, featured on the new album Music Is My Mistress, with Mercer Ellington conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra. Can you tell us what a rehearsal would be like with Duke Ellington?
Well, first off, the 2 o'clock rehearsal got started around about 3:15, and then the guys would come in, they would put down the music, and start playing it, and it would sound like the worst thing in the world by the third playing of it. It took on a sound which was completely different and completely identifiable as something that could only be Duke Ellington. And it depended on what he thought of it and what the purpose of what he was rehearsing was for. Many times, for no reason at all, he would rehearse a tune and spend 5 or 6 hours on just one number. And on another occasion, he would just play the number twice and find that the engineers didn't get it properly if we were in a record date. And then he'd declare, well, okay, that's enough time on that because now the feeling is gone and the soloist can't come up with the same emotion that he had on the first time of playing it. So he'd abandon it until we got to the next studio and next rehearsal, go over it again, studio, rehearsal, until one day he decided, well, now we got the one that's right. So that a rehearsal with Ellington was never something that was like systematic or that you knew there would be some form of methodology that would be called for.
You are, with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, playing some of Ellington's neglected works, some of the extended works, as well as some of his most popular compositions. When you take out a work that hasn't been played in a long time and you're looking at the score, is it difficult to read? And I ask you that because in a memoir that you wrote about your father, Duke Ellington, you say that he frequently wrote really cryptically because he was afraid that people would steal his composition, which was, I guess, pretty common then, that people would steal other people's ideas. So he'd write it so it couldn't be stolen that easily. Are you stuck with having to decipher that now?
No, not really, because I did so much copying that I recognized his symbols and all the little things he did to disguise the music. For instance, one of them would be to write a part and put the wrong clef sign on it. So if somebody had started naming the notes, they'd have it completely messed up. The other thing was to use, you know, this cryptic titling on numbers so that if you heard a number and you wanted to get it out of the book, like, for instance, you know, he'd make an arrangement that was, say, a new concept of In My Solitude, you'd never find it. If you wanted to say, you know, he did a tune called Squeeze Me. Well, on one occasion, it would be titled Slew Slew. And then another time, he called it Subtle Slough. So if you looked in the in the music to try to, say, take the parts out and copy them over or get some kind of idea of what was happening, you couldn't recognize the tune by the writing that was on it, well, because the saxophones had one name on it and the trombones had another, and you could never really piece them together.
So how common was stealing through sheet music?
Well, in the days, I mean, it was very blatant at one point. And even in the old Cotton Club days, the guys from downtown would come in with their pencils in their hands and just blatantly sit there with the music and sit in the front row copying down what they heard.
It's amazing. In Music Is My Mistress, your father's collection of memoirs and reminiscences about musicians, he wrote a couple of pages about you, and he started it by saying, "My son Mercer Ellington is dedicated to maintaining the luster of his father's image." Did you ever feel that he perhaps took that for granted?
No, but what he's doing, in essence, he was saying something in print that he could never say to me individually. And it was not necessarily meant for the reader as much as it was meant for me, because he had the difficulty of being able to talk intimately to me. I have the same difficulty. If I had to say to my wife or my children or something else that they did something I liked, I'd find it difficult to make the statement. I think this was his way of expressing approval of what many of the things I had done, or saying thanks for having done it.
Did he spend a lot of time with you? I know when you were growing up, your parents separated when you were pretty young. You divided your time between each of their houses. Did you get to see him much? Were you close?
Oh, yeah. And in those days, I spent 50-50. Mm-hmm. As far as my time was concerned, one half of the year with my mother, or, you know, 2 weeks here and 2 weeks there and so forth. And I got the value of two worlds, and each was very important. I got the value of living, as they would say, high on the hog, because I'd be around Pop and the important people that he knew, and a lot of the, you know, great stars in show business, Fats Waller, Art Tatum, and so forth. And with my mother, we lived an average, everyday existence. No one knew who I was. I was just somebody else on the street. And I got to know how that kind of a person lived, and I never got to the place where I felt I rose above that, that I was not, you know, someone who was highly privileged and could afford to ignore the feelings or the way anyone else felt. So I think for that reason, the way I raised was, in a sense, a rich possession to have.
In a memoir that you wrote about your father, you said that he really wasn't prepared to have children when you were born, and if he was going to have a child, he probably would have preferred a girl, so that when you were raised to please your father, you had to wear these long braids.
We used to call them plaits.
What I couldn't figure out was whether that was something you remembered or something you were told later by your family.
Well, my mother's the one that told me.
How did you feel about it when you found out?
It didn't make any difference to me.
Oh, okay.
I was glad that I was a boy. I'm glad he didn't get his wish.
Do you have any of your father's show business superstitions? He had a lot of superstitions,
didn't
he?
Oh, he's gotten us all, you know, a place where we've been brainwashed. And when it gets down to it, there were only two colors which he really, you know, allowed, and that was blue and white. And then once in a while, he allowed a little red to come in. I guess maybe that had to do with his patriotism. But that would you dare not whistle in the dressing room, nor bring in a newspaper, nor peanuts. And this, and he hated green. Green was always bad luck to him.
Where do these things come from? Do you have any idea?
Well, it came related to experiences. He hated green, and he hated brown because he was wearing a brown suit the day his mother died.
Oh.
And so he had a reason behind it, an experience to relate to.
So would you wear brown now?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay.
I wear green. He did. He, however, did not object to green on the back of dollar bills.
Keeping the Duke Ellington Orchestra together now, how many alumni from the Ellington Orchestra are there now?
Well, when you say alumni, you know, you can only go back about 27 years. And that starts with Chuck Connors, our bass trombone player. And aside from that, we have Barry Lee Hall, who's the soloist on Danish Eyes, and Rocky White, our drummer. So we have approximately four or five of us left, if you count myself. And the rest of the guys have been there after Ellington. And we've had to indoctrinate them, in a sense, so that they could kind of get the feel of what it was all about.
So how do you indoctrinate the new members?
Well, first off, when we ride the bus, we adhere to the tradition. The new man goes to the back of the bus. And they delight when the new man is Caucasian, because the first thing they do is jump and say, tell him he's in the back of the bus. And to imply that things are just the reverse as the old days. But in addition to that, while we were riding, you know, particularly a lot of times, like we pack up, his adage was that we should move like a circus. And when we finished the job, if it was possible, strike the tents, get on the bus, and get to your next city. So while we're doing that, we put the tapes on the sound system in the bus. And while the guys are sleeping or whatever, we just keep Ellington playing all night long. And they begin to hear it. We begin to explain to them what happened. We make them listen to records in rehearsals, and then play what we are demonstrating on the record itself.
Since so many people know you as the son of Duke Ellington, are people surprised when they find out that you're getting older yourself? You were born in 1919. Do you know what I mean? I think in a lot of people's eyes, you're going to be just perpetually very young.
I mean, Ellington has caused a tremendous oversight on my age for quite a while. In the old days, he used to say he didn't want anyone to know he had a son with gray hair because it might keep the chicks away. And then he's still at it even as of now, because I told people, and we had quite a do, you know, in this past month, celebrating his 90th birthday. And so they all got to where, they, you know, we got around and took care of each other and everything like that. And all of a sudden they said something about, well, you shouldn't be tired. I explained to them, I said, you know, you've all been so busy celebrating Duke Ellington's 90th birthday that you've forgotten that I'm on my 70th. And I'd like to get some sleep for a change.
Mercer Ellington, I thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much for joining us on Fresh
Air. It's been very pleasant, Terry.
My guest has been Mercer Ellington, and his new recording, conducting the Duke Ellington Orchestra, is called Music Is My Mistress, and it features several new compositions by Mercer Ellington. It's on the Music Masters record label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the Washington Squares, a band that describes itself as continuing the folk process without playing processed folk. Describing a composer's music as movie music is often a derogatory statement, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz asks the question, can movie music played outside of the movies also be good music? He reviews a collection of Bernard Herrmann scores for the films of Alfred Hitchcock. And critic Maureen Carrigan reads the New York Times wedding page and finds its hidden messages about America's class structure. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Yasser Arafat said today that the PLO charter calling for the destruction of Israel has been superseded by a declaration calling for peaceful coexistence with the Jewish state. Arafat, ending a two-day visit to France, did not suggest any formal action to reword or scrap the charter, but French President François Mitterrand said Arafat's statements were a step toward clearing up the contradiction between the charter and more recent PLO statements recognizing the existence of Israel and renouncing terrorism. In a Paris news conference, Arafat revealed that the Soviet Union has secured serious participation in a proposed international peace conference on the Middle East. Israel has rejected the idea of such a conference. In Lebanon, there's been a breakthrough to end 8 weeks of fighting. Christian Army Commander Michel Aoun has suspended his blockade of Muslim militia ports to give Arab foreign ministers a chance to find a lasting solution to the country's latest crisis. Mike Theodoulou reports.
Aoun's statement came after he met with two Arab League envoys who arrived in Lebanon today, and it means that the Christians are no longer at war with the Syrians and their Muslim militia allies. The Syrians had refused to obey the ceasefire until Aoun called off his ports blockade, as the truce had demanded. But the blockade, which sparked the violence in the first place 8 weeks ago, is now lifted, and the Arab League has 3 months in which to put together proposals for a comprehensive settlement of the Lebanese crisis. In the meantime, the Arab League is bringing in an observer force of 312 troops, drawn from member states to monitor the truce. Already, there is a feeling of immense relief in Beirut. People were out on the streets today, and for the first time in weeks, shops, businesses, and factories were open. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodoulou in Nicosia.
President Bush said today that it would be a mistake to negotiate with the Soviet Union on short-range nuclear missile reductions. Bush spelled out his position to Norwegian Prime Minister Gro Brundtland at a White House meeting. Brundtland said she believed the U.S. could find common ground with West Germany, which wants the missiles eliminated. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater suggested the disagreement was not likely to be resolved before Bush and the other NATO leaders attend a summit meeting in Brussels later this month. Cambodian resistance leader Prince Norodom Sihanouk announced today that he is willing to return to Cambodia as head of state if Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen follows through on conditions discussed during 2 days of peace talks in Jakarta. More on the story from Mary Kay Magstead.
Calling himself the father of Cambodia and saying Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen is my child, a bad boy, but not all bad, former Cambodian leader Prince Norodom Sihanouk said today that he's willing to go back to Cambodia this autumn as head of state under certain conditions that Hun Sen has already said are possible. One is that Vietnam makes good on its promise to withdraw its remaining troops by September. Another is that the existing socialist Cambodian constitution be modified to allow a multi-party democratic political system in independent Cambodia. Sihanouk said if Hun Sen followed through on such demands and the Khmer Rouge did not go along with conditions of a Hun Sen-Sihanouk deal, he would shut them out of a future Cambodian government. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead.
Opposition leaders in Panama warned today that Panamanians may react with violence if there is fraud in this weekend's election. An opposition candidate said the vote was the last peaceful opportunity for change and that if the will of the people is violated, there will be a spontaneous reaction. The opposition has accused General Manuel Noriega and his supporters of padding voter registration lists and intimidating voters in an attempt to steal the presidential elections. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 9 points, closing at 2393.7. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Movie music is usually a pejorative term among classical music lovers, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has been listening to a new album of music from Alfred Hitchcock's films, and Lloyd wonders if movie music played outside of the movies can also be good music.
Background music in the movies is supposed to affect your mood, heighten the suspense, make you feel romantic, give you the creeps, or underline how silly or cute someone is behaving. But you're not exactly supposed to listen to it. It's not there to call attention to itself. Maybe that's why when a serious composer produces an inflated, soupy, melodramatic score derivative of Rachmaninoff or Tchaikovsky or Bartok or Ligeti, we can dismiss it as movie music. But there's no question that some extremely talented composers have done some impressive work for film. Alex North, Dmitri Tiomkin, Max Steiner, more recently John Williams and Ennio Morricone, and the composer of music for many of Alfred Hitchcock's American films, Bernard Herrmann. Herrmann, unlike many of his contemporary movie composers, was not born in Europe, but in New York City in 1911. He died in 1975. He attended NYU and Juilliard, and besides his movie scores, his best-known composition is his opera, Wuthering Heights. He also wrote ballets and a cantata called Moby Dick. His first Hitchcock film was the minor comedy The Trouble with Harry in 1956, and Herrmann's charming New England atmosphere might very well be the best thing about that movie. He went on to do The Man Who Knew Too Much, The Wrong Man, Vertigo, one of the great scores, North by Northwest, Psycho, and Marnie. Herrmann also wrote the music for such remarkably diverse films as Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons, Jane Eyre, The Snows of Kilimanjaro, King of the Khyber Rifles, and Truffaut's Fahrenheit 451. In 1941, he won his only Oscar for The Devil and Daniel Webster. On a recent album of Alfred Hitchcock's film music, we hear the suites from Psycho and North by Northwest. Herrmann himself conducts the suite from Psycho, and the minute you hear the exciting opening notes, you not only remember the film, you remember hearing the music, too. A good score can linger in your mind, even if you're not fully conscious of it. And the music also stands on its own. I want to hear the recording over and over again, without necessarily wanting to see the movie. I love those driving rhythms, rhythms of escape. I guess I can't quite forget the story, the way they alternate with that sweeping melody in the strings. By Northwest, I was surprised at the flamenco rhythms, the castanets and tambourines. I certainly don't remember this dazzling Spanish orchestration from the movie. Is it the whirling dance of international intrigue? ¶¶ Herman's most distinctive writing is for strings, which can be extremely compact and intense, yet forward-moving at the same time. I hear the influences of Ravel, Stravinsky, and Bartok, and even Mahler. But I also very much hear Herman's own sensibility, his delicacy and taste. Both his love themes and his suspense music are refined, subtly melodic, never drippy or melodramatic. And the suites are beautifully put together. The repeated themes are like an obsessive rondo, maybe even more powerful alone than when they are reflecting the obsessions of particular characters in certain movies.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Alfred Hitchcock's film music on the Milan label. This is Fresh Air. Members of the band The Washington Squares are veteran punk rockers who left that scene in 1983 to play folk music, but they didn't leave the new wave beat behind. The members of the band are Tom Goodkind, Bruce Pascoe, and Lauren Agnelli, along with honorary member drummer Billy Ficca, who played with the punk band Television. They've just released their second album called Fair and Square. From that album, here's Fourth Day of July. You play folk songs, but you play them like rock.
Yeah, well, the thing is that folk songs are traditional songs with no known writer. It doesn't really matter how you play the folk song, as long as it is folk material. No one etched in stone that the rules with folk songs is that it must be played on acoustic instruments a certain Appalachian way. I think that would categorize the music in such a way that was extremely stifling.
Bruce, you're a really good rock guitarist. What made you want to play songs that come out of folk music?
Well, first of all, I really was looking for some kind of meaning in the music. I was very kind of disenchanted with the strictures of modern pop music, especially at the time when we started the band. And I was kind of a little bored with just playing electric guitar. And so for me, it was just an interesting way to, and a challenging way to do something a little different.
You had been playing in punk bands in New York?
Yes, a number of different punk bands.
Had you gotten tired of that?
Well, I hate to sound like an old fuddy-duddy, but I got really tired of the volume. And I got tired of the crowds were just sort of pointlessly nihilistic. And I thought that it would be much better if people were going to be against something, if they were against something that was productive to be against, like Ronald Reagan and repression and the fight for freedom of speech, etc., to be for that.
Lauren, you were singing with punk bands, weren't you?
I played also.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I played rhythm guitar, uh-huh. I played organ, I played synthesizer, but I kept writing songs, and I had a great love of music, and I loved to be on stage. Had a great time.
What made you want to leave New Wave for the kind of music that you're doing now?
Well, basically, the band broke up, and I wanted to move to England in the early 80s to become like a country singer or something, but I had to come back to New York. I didn't want to lose my apartment, and you know, my visa ran up, and then I was waitressing, and these guys met me, and they remembered me from the old old days. And they wanted to get a female in the band with them, God bless them. So, you know, that's how I started being in this band. I was already kind of off playing with amplifiers. I sold most of my equipment when I moved to England. And so I was looking to do something with a little different instrumentation and feeling and, you know, sure, writing different kinds of songs. That appealed to me.
Tom, you had been booking acts at the Peppermint Lounge, a new wave club in New York. What tired you of that scene?
I really enjoyed that scene. I had a great time there seeing all the bands coming through. But what tired me was MTV had suddenly started playing what we had taken so long to bring up in a way that it sort of lost its countercultural edge. And it was time to go on to some other form of music. I found a rockabilly band sitting in my office talking about how their daddy had just joined the KKK and how proud they were. And I said, it was time to say check, please, and move on to the next restaurant.
Whose idea was it to start playing folk songs?
It was all of ours. I mean, what happened was we were rehearsing as an acoustic group, and we started to sing great harmonies. Bruce and I went back to his house. Screw around, we said, why don't we... We've been screwing around with Sloop John B. and Michael Row the Boat Ashore and If I Had a Hammer. Why don't we try singing these things? Because if we don't sing them, they might not go on to another generation. There might be a halting of this folk process. And it would give us something a little bit more to do than just play pop music for large audiences. It might be very interesting. The politics sort of came in later, but the idea of actually singing folk music came in quite quickly.
You have some surprising songs on the new record. The one that surprises me the most is Greenback Dollar. Now, I really think of that as one of the squarest songs to get revived or to come out of the folk revival. It was a Kingston Trio hit.
Right.
I really like the way you do it, and I really couldn't believe you were doing it.
We've been doing it at the end of our concerts since 84, I think. I mean, it's been our big concert closer, you know, the rave up. And we love doing that song. It's a great song.
Well, whose idea was it to do it? Who heard the potential first in that song?
Greenback Dollar was a camp song that we all learned as campers, and it came naturally. When we first started listing songs we wanted to attempt, all three of us ran for that song.
Some people say I'm a new camp. Others say I'm no good. Yeah, but I'm just a natural born traveling man, doing what I think I should. Yeah, I'm doing what I think I should. And I don't give a damn about a greenback, a dollar. Spend it fast as I can.
Were you used to singing tight harmonies, the three of you, before you started singing together?
Well, in my other band, we sang some harmonies, but they weren't this tight. I mean, three-part harmony is quite demanding, wouldn't you say?
Bruce and I spent about a year and a half in my office at the Peppermint Lounge singing. I mean, when I was supposed to be working, which is one of the reasons I'm no longer working there. But it sounded great. I mean, it sounded like tight Everly Brothers harmony. We knew we needed a third. We went in search for Lauren. I don't recommend this to you children at home, but it's the kind of thing where if you find a three-part harmony that works, where your neighbors aren't banging on your doors to be quiet but are telling you, we want to come in and listen, quit your jobs and go for it. I mean, it's an amazing thing.
The water is wide.
The impression I always had of your band was that you started off doing folk songs ironically, and then the deeper you got into it, the more serious you got about it. Is that right, or am I totally off track?
We were always serious about playing folk music. It's just that there had been such a dominant cabaret scene in New York that when we got up there and we did our our whatever you call it, our Weavers, our Peter, Paul, and Mary, our Kingston Trio, they looked at us and said, God, what a cute act. What a joke this is. What a great idea. And they wrote us up as a parody. We really weren't, but we went along with it for a little while just because it got us bookings. Luckily, that's past us now.
And it's also because we had such great sense in dressing ourselves.
You wore beatnik outfits. I'm not sure if you still did. And to the press, you handed out beatnik kits.
We've always had a sense of irony and a sense of self-parody and a sense of humor. And I think that we've learned that what we really aspire to be is a great band. And as much as we had fun with the Beatnik kits and the whole image, people did get confused. They didn't know whether we were a band or a parody. So in our presentation now, we're a little more focused in that we're a band first and foremost.
The Washington Square's new album, Fair and Square, is on Gold Castle Records. That holy mountain, dearest of, this is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Noah Adams and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program, a description of the mood in China, in Beijing especially. There, tomorrow on Thursday, a large student demonstration is expected on the 70th anniversary of the first student protest for democracy in China in 1919. Also, we'll talk with Anthony Falzo. He is a Conrail conductor, and on Monday, he jumped down from the engine of his train in New Jersey and saved a 3-year-old boy and an 18-month-old boy, brothers playing on the tracks. Also, the United Methodist Church is changing its hymnal to take out sexist and racist references. For example, the hymn God of Our Father now becomes God of the Ages.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This is the most popular time of year for weddings. Lately, critic Maureen Corrigan has been reading between the lines of one of the most venerable forums for nuptial news.
I've read the Sunday New York Times wedding announcements for years now because they're so reassuring. In our chaotic world where people struggle with commitment and self-identity, the wedding announcements offer a utopian vision of a community where the right people continue to meet and marry each other. Technically, the wedding pages are a democratic space. Anyone, regardless of their pedigree, can place an announcement for $17.95 per line. But nobody I know has ever bothered, not even Donna Kaminsky, a childhood friend from Queens. Her wedding to Vic, a guy in the mafia, was the most lavish I've ever attended. Donna and Vic glided into their wedding reception, seated in a pink mechanical swan. Dry ice swirled round the ballroom, and the band played the theme from The Godfather. What an affair! What a couple! But in the Times, they would have looked like peasants. First of all, Donna and Vic would have been buried at the bottom of the wedding page because it's laid out like one of those ocean liners that carried immigrants to this country at the turn of the century. Wasps monopolized the top berths while Catholics, Jews, and dark-skinned peoples huddled below in steerage. The photos on the page also distinguish the DuPonts and Carnegies of this world from the commoners. The Times Society editor solicits photos from only the most prominent brides. Their announcements run for free, so much for democracy. In the last decade, couple photos have appeared more often on the page. I think maybe this is because of the way feminism has redefined our relationships. A wedding is no longer just the bride's big day, but something the groom is involved in, too. I've noticed something else. Half the brides and grooms in these photos look like mirror images, and only half the new marriages in this country succeed. What role does mutual narcissism play in keeping marriages together? We won't know for sure until the Times begins running divorce announcements with photos. To rise to the top of the wedding page, even an Episcopalian couple who share the same gene pool need wealthy, learned, and powerful male ancestors. Here's a model announcement from last Sunday's Times.
The Princeton University Chapel was the setting for the wedding of Nancy Goddard Boardman and James Douglas Sparkman, Jr. The bride is a freelance writer. The groom is a descendant of Pierre Placot, a Huguenot whose house, completed in 1707, still stands in New Rochelle. A Huguenot in the family guarantees a couple a splashy announcement and a photo. So do political connections, however obscure. In February, Heather Hatfield and Donald Gibble announced their engagement along with the news that Miss Hatfield is the great-great-granddaughter of James S. Sherman, the Vice President of the United States from 1909 to 1912. Is this how Dan Quayle's descendants will define themselves in 100 years? Maybe these couples seem so idyllic because they're all following the same script, one that comes to closure at the peak of newly wedded bliss before kids or boredom disrupts the plot. The Times perpetuates its enabling fictions of marriage by making sure that all their wedding announcements are fit to print.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Bryn Mawr College and reviews books for the Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet mystery writer Sue Grafton. The protagonist of her mystery series, Kinsey Millhone, is one of a new breed of hard-boiled women detectives. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Full Moon Fever, the new album from Tom Petty. And film critic Stephen Schiff pays tribute to the late Italian director Sergio Leone. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.